Welcome to the Wolf Connection podcast. I'm your host, John Kalfa. Let's talk about some wolves. Today, joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota, at the University of Minnesota, is Jack Raby. Right now, he's a master's student in conservation sciences at the University of Minnesota, but he's also worked for U.S. Fish and Wildlife and with Yellowstone with the wolf, cougar, and elk projects. Jack, how you doing over there in Minnesota?
It's good to be here. How are you guys doing?
No, we're doing good. We're in three different parts of the country. I love this. I had to do some finagling time-wise. So we have the Pacific time zone covered, the Mountain time zone covered, and the Central Standard time zone covered. So I think... I know. And then we're trying to coordinate it with Jack to make sure that I don't mess it up. So we got it all squared away. So another first for our podcast.
I imagine we're experiencing some vastly different weather and environments too.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you got? How is it in Minnesota? Is it snowing up there?
No snow today, but we have, about 2 to 5 degrees this morning and -10-15 wind chill. So it's getting cold here.
But no snow.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, no snow. Really, really little snowfall. And it's been the same out west over in Yellowstone. We haven't had too much this year so far.
I know out here we're supposed to get in the Los Angeles area, we're supposed to be getting some snow and rain mixture in the mountains, I think, in the next week or so. I think there's about 3 or 4 days where there's a 40 to 50% chance, which usually means it's going to rain or snow out here. So that's going to be good for us.
We had like a foot here, and we probably have 8 out of the next 10 days will be snowing here.
Oh, wow.
And then Steven's going to be on his way back to California for a couple of projects and working with us. So he'll be back. Hopefully you won't be riding in that. So Jack, just give us some background a little bit in your early work. Cause I know you kind of, much like Dylan and some of your other colleagues, you guys really sort of run the gamut and you do all these different wonderful projects and you go sort of all over the place. So you started off work in I think it's Farallon Islands National Wildlife Refuge. Let me know if I pronounce that right. And that's off the California coast. So how did you get involved, when you first graduated with your bachelor's and moving into, forest, fish, and wildlife?
Yeah, definitely. So I grew up in Northeast Ohio, went to the Ohio State University, and my first internship was doing some coyote and bobcat camera work down in Southeast Ohio. And then in between my junior and senior year in that summer, I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to go do some seabird invasive plant work out on the Farallon Islands. So that island's located 28 miles off the coast of San Francisco. On a clear day, which is pretty rare out there, you can see the island from the mainland. And what I was mostly doing, the island's pretty small. It's only around 750 acres, but it's home to almost 1 million seabirds across the conglomerate of 2 or 3 islands. And it holds some of the largest seabird colonies for a number of those species. So I was out there on the island doing a lot of invasive plant work. So back in the day, a lot of invasive plants, some rodents got introduced to the island. So we've worked pretty hard to try and remove that, give the island some better habitat for some of those seabirds that are endangered or struggling.
So what sort of plants and rodents there were introduced that weren't native to those islands that you were trying to remove?
Yeah, so the predominant invasive plant is New Zealand spinach, which I think you can eat it just like normal spinach to some degree. And then house mice, and at one point there were cats as well, but those got exterminated from the area. And I think right now the island has the highest density of mice of any other island in the world, somewhere around there. So there's some big problems in terms of some of the invasives that we've been working hard to remove. And I was a part of that for a summer. So,
and what are the effects that those mice are having? Because I guess from the outside looking in, you would think that would be some prey, or that would be some sustenance for, I guess, some of the animals and maybe some of the birds that are on that island. But what are the negative effects that they're having when they're there?
Yeah, so it's kind of a perfect storm where some of those invasive plants that ended up covering and kind of blanketing a lot of those areas that otherwise wouldn't have vegetation, are providing cover for those mice from predation by other species like birds. And the problem with the mice is that they can be a pretty big predator of a lot of the nests and eggs that those seabirds lay. So they can really decimate some of the survivals of chicks or of egg and nest productivity in that sense.
Mm.
And what are the birds that are native to that island that you and your colleagues and your group are trying to help rebound?
Yeah, so the refuge was initially established to protect an endangered species called the ashy storm petrel, which is a really small black bird, you know, maybe the size of my fist, that would live in these rock crevices, nocturnal, come out at night, and that's when we would capture them and tag them and take all these measurements. Another one is the common murre, which is well known across kind of the whole coast all the way up to Alaska. And on the island, they had colonies of up to, I think, 300,000. On the one mainland, it was 150,000 in, you know, a couple hundred acres. So this massive colony of seabirds covering, you know, every square inch of the island in some places.
It's amazing how it's such a tiny, you would think, like, you know, like you said, a mouse would have such a devastating effect on birds. You would think they'd be able to coexist that way. It's interesting to hear that perspective from you. So how did you move from working off the coast of San Francisco? Was it just a natural move coming back east, I guess? How did you end up in Yellowstone National Park and getting an internship there or a volunteership there?
Yeah, so Yellowstone was kind of an interesting story. So this is kind of the power of networking and, you know, just knowing people at the right time and right place. So growing up, I had known this international law professor in Cleveland area, and my mom cut his hair for a living growing up my whole life. And he just so happened to be childhood friends with Doug Smith, who happens to be the, you know, head of the Yellowstone Wolf Project. He also grew up in the Cleveland, Ohio area. And he was, you know, grateful enough to, you know, pass my resume and a cover letter on to him and said, you know, I got this kid over here who's done a lot of stuff in wildlife, really wants to work with carnivores, wolves, you know, maybe give him a shot. And that kind of opened the door for like getting a chance. And then a lot of my other references and recommendations that I got from past professors or from the people working out on the Farallons really set me up for that summer field position right after I graduated from Ohio State.
Well, we need to do, Stephen, I think, a podcast just on the 6 degrees of Doug Smith. Like, we, there's always a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Because leading it's up amazing. To his episode, I hope.
when Doug finally, you know, gets free for our podcast, I'm going to ask him how he's able. It's amazing how much he's infiltrated all these different stories of how you've all gotten here to this point. It's really fascinating how he has such a far reach, even just from that one point in the United States. So when you land, did you start in the Cougar Project first? I can't remember, because we're going to cover all this, because you cover the wolf, cougar, and elk projects. Which one was your first assignment, I guess, that you were able to get into?
Yeah, so my first tech job was a summer predation field tech. So what we were doing was following collared wolves and cougars at the same time throughout that whole first summer that I was working there. Mm-hmm. And we were going to what we call GPS clusters, which are essentially clusters of GPS points from these animals that we would go to. They'd spend a lot of time there, and usually it was either a bed site or a kill site where they had been feeding. So we would go to those sites and basically investigate the area and see what we'd find.
Are these GPS coordinates, like, how accurate are we talking here?
Yeah, so usually sometimes we'd get there and there would be a point directly where the like carcass was.
Oh, wow.
Other times it might be 10 meters off, but usually there's an error of maybe, you know, 5 meters or like 10 feet at most. So they're really accurate.
That's unreal. And how often are the collars sending coordinates back to whatever receiving software you're using, or hardware, I guess?
Yeah, so it's really it's really up to our discretion. So we kind of do a play of, you know, how long do we want the battery to live?
I see.
And how long do, you know, we want to do this study, and then how much detail do we want in our data? So usually in the winter, we'll shoot for an hour, because that usually captures all of the prey that wolves and cougars are feeding on. Cougars, we actually do 3-hour points because it's just them. So they stay at a kill much longer. Where in the summer, where wolves are eating a lot younger prey, they're not staying in that area as long. We drop it down to 30 minutes.
I see. So it's a balancing of priorities, how long you want to study, you know, the battery life versus how much data you want to collect in a certain period of time.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the times when we're not doing those like specific geared study periods, kind of the what we call the off season, we dial it all the way back to like 4 or 6 hour points. So we're only getting locations every, you know, 4 times a day.
Right.
So what do you, what kind of data points are you trying to get from both the wolf kill sites and the cougar kill sites? What are the things that you guys are looking for?
Yeah. So when we get to those kill sites, it's really like, you know, being in part of like a forensics lab. We're trying to get to the kill site and figure out who did it. You know, did that animal die from disease, malnutrition, which is a big thing in late winter after they've, you know, been struggling all year or all winter? Or did that animal, you know, the wolf or the cougar that we're following, did that actually make the kill and then subsequently feed on it? And sometimes it'll be, you know, we have 2 or 3 different wolf packs that'll feed on a kill, or a cougar made the kill, and then one of our collared wolves came in and stole it from the cougar. So you can get these really complex things just from a couple GPS points. But what we're really trying to figure out is what type of prey species the wolf or cougar killed, how old it was, what type of body condition it was in. So poor, good, fair. And then those are kind of the main points. Sex can be important too. But those are the big ones.
Do you find anything specific that you were finding? What were most of the kills that you, if you can recall, that wolves were really taking, or cougars too? Was it mostly like most of the scientists and the biologists that we've been talking to, are they typically older males, females, whatever it is, or skewed to younger calves and things of that sort?
Yeah, so it's really variable depending on the time of year. So early summer and kind of throughout the summer, they're really targeting those young, what we call neonates, so kind of newborn elk calves. And then the elk calves throughout that summertime. So I think it's somewhere around, you know, 65-70% of the animals that we're finding at these kill sites are those young elk. And that changes throughout the year to, you know, older elk or things once those calves get bigger and healthier and less vulnerable.
How complex is it at a kill site where you were saying just before you have, let's say a cougar makes a kill, but then a wolf pack swoops in and takes the majority of the meat? And granted, these animal, you know, these elk and bison that get taken down, depending on what it is, it's hundreds of pounds of meat. So it's not as though there's not enough meat, I guess, to go around. But how complex is that dynamic for all of these predators and then these birds and everybody to sort of feast on this same piece of, you know, carrion? And do you see a lot of interfacing or you know, fighting between these animals to get to this carcass?
Yeah, definitely. So I've also been fortunate to, you know, have a number of different roles on these projects throughout the 3 or 4 years that I worked there. And one thing I did was the winter study observation work. So I would sit out and watch these wolf packs and follow them around every day for, you know, a whole month or two. And sometimes when they'd make a kill, especially if it was, you know, a big bison or even a bison they're scavenging on, they attract so many different and diverse species. I mean, you'd have on one kill a whole wolf pack, and then, you know, as many as 15 to 20 eagles come in and feed on it, or almost 100 ravens. And then by, you know, within an hour or two of them making that kill, a bear could have picked up the scent. And next thing you know, there's 10 bears on it. So one time I saw the Wapiti Lake wolf pack where it was 13 wolves and then another 11 grizzly bears. And they were all kind of going back and forth throughout the day fighting over that carcass. And sometimes the wolves will be successful and run a bear off if it has cubs. But if it's a big male, there's almost no chance. And I've seen from the plane a big grizzly defend a carcass from 19 wolves at one time. So it's pretty impressive.
So were you ever trying to get to a kill site while there was a pack or a lion still eating it? Or are you always showing up to a kill site after the predators have sort of capitalized on the kill and have left the scene?
Yeah, so this is where it is really like a, you know, forensic, like you're going to the scene of the crime to try and figure out what happened. So we typically wait around a week after the kill was made and after wolves left to go in on that area.
I see.
Part of that is trying to avoid any disturbance. So we want those, you know, wolves or cougars or bears or other scavengers to get as much off of that carcass as possible before we go in and disturb it.
Right.
Because wolves might not come back to that, or cougars might not come back to it if we go there. Scavengers probably would, but we don't want to risk it. And then part of it during bear season is just safety.
Sure.
Necessity of trying to avoid going in on an active carcass where a grizzly might still be, you know, hunkered down feeding on it.
Yeah, I imagine there's, yeah, like you said, safety involved, trying to figure that out. What were the packs? Because you said the Wapiti Lake pack. Were there any particular ones through the, what do you say, four? I think you said 4 years or four seasons. What were the packs that you typically were studying kill sites on? Was it any particular ones, or were you kind of running the gamut and sort of going all over the park?
Yeah, so for the GPS cluster and predation work, we really just focus in on that northern strip of the park because it's just the most accessible interior of the park, especially in the winter. It's all snowmobile. There's really no accessibility down there. A lot harsher. So in the summer and winter times, all of our predation work is on that northern range, which every year was either the Junction Butte pack, which is now a really famous pack out there, or the 8 Mile pack, which both have been there for a number of years now. They're pretty stable.
I know we're supposed to be talking about the wolf and elk dynamic, but I mountain lions are my favorite critter out there, so I can't help it. But is there any kind of obvious relationship between wolf pack numbers and mountain lion numbers? I mean, how do they collaborate in the greater scheme of things?
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I every time I see a cougar or do more work with them, I'm fascinated by them. They're just such cool critters.
Yeah.
So over the last 10 to 15 years, we've really seen kind of the same pattern of stable numbers across wolf and cougars. So cougars on the northern range, right about, you know, maybe 35 to 40 individuals. And then wolves, almost right about at that same number on the northern range of Yellowstone. So right around 40 to 50. In the whole park, around 100. But we don't really monitor cougars outside the northern range because that's really where their sweet spot is, and there's just not a lot of great habitat for them in the interior of the park. And for cougars especially, it's a lot harder to monitor because you can't just, you know, fly over and spot a cougar hunkered down in a patch of regen or thick trees, where with wolves it's just a lot easier based on the habitat they use.
Yeah, I agree with both of you, man. Cougars are, they're so fascinating, and they're just they're incredible animals. What, in that 10 to 15 year span, have you seen when the reintroduction sort of happened, did you see the same sort of cascade effect that all these other species were normalizing, as well as with cougars? In other words, like the cougar population started to come back in. I don't know what the numbers were before the introduction, and then where they are, as you said, they're stable and normalized now. How was that relationship in terms of when wolves got reintroduced?
Yeah, so cougars, kind of owing to their, you know, cryptic, secretive nature, they're just hard to see. They recolonized Yellowstone on their own doing in the mid to late 80s. And that's when our first a study of cougars happened in Yellowstone. At that time, the numbers were, you know, maybe around 15 to 20 or so. And since then, mid-2000s, the number jumped up to maybe 25 to 35. And it seems like since, you know, the last 15 to 20 years, it's hovered right about that 30 to 40 number. So they climbed and then stabilized out around the same time that wolves and some of the other species have.
Is that normal for them as a species to really just sort of, they don't seem to overpopulate themselves. Are they like wolves in that way, that if there's really not enough game or prey to take down or to feed themselves or their litter, that they're essentially, maybe they don't reproduce as much, or that, I know they're very solitary animals. So what's their dynamic like inside the park in terms of not, I guess, overpopulating themselves?
Yeah, so it's just like with a lot of other predators and just like wolves, it's very reliant on food availability. So if the food isn't there, you know, if the population spikes one year, it might not be able to stay at that level because there's just not enough food to go around. So then it would naturally regulate itself, and survival of, you know, a litter of kittens might not be as well for a year or two, or they just might not even produce litters because they don't have the energy or the food to do it. So you can see those similar dynamics that you would with wolves kind of naturally regulating around those prey populations. But they're very territorial too, just like wolves. So space is another limiting factor, especially when you do have a lot of prey on the landscape, like in Yellowstone.
And so they're regulated just to that, like you said, that northern part of the park. I guess that northern corridor, and they don't venture down just because of the terrain or because of the prey. What's the reasoning that they don't venture down too much into the southern part of the park?
Yeah, so we do certainly have some individuals down there. We did have one male that we captured up on the northern range, and then shortly after we collared it, it took about a 25-mile journey down into the interior and actually spent the whole winter down there. So I don't really know what it was feeding on. But a lot of it is driven by prey availability. So down in the interior of Yellowstone, a lot of the elk and deer, which is the primary prey of the cougar, move out of those high elevation areas because the snow is so deep that it's just hard for them to move and find, you know, adequate forage for them to eat throughout the winter. So a lot of it is, you know, following where the prey go. But cougars also like those, you know, steep terrains, densely forested areas where they can, you know, have this ambush spot to, you know, take their prey down, where wolves like those big open valleys or they'll use forests, but cougars are really reliant on that ambush terrain. And that northern strip of the Yellowstone River, which we call the Black Canyon, is just perfect for that. And there's not a lot of snowfall, which is good for the cougars because it gives them some good cover to ambush, and they can just move around easier than they would in, you know, the interior.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable how they hunt on such steep country.
Yeah, there's a huge difference between the kill sites that we go to in terms of terrain of cougars versus wolves.
And wolves, yeah.
You kind of have to gauge when we have techs come in, like, okay, like how comfortable are you with, you know, working along cliff sides or, you know, steep 45 degree slopes and rocky areas and all this. Where wolves, it's like, yeah, you're fine walking in a valley next to a river. Nobody's not good with that, but it can get pretty dicey working with cougars and following them around.
What's the craziest kill site you've been to when you were there? Both, I guess, in landscape and what you saw.
Or even something like unexplainable that you might have come up on.
Some of the coolest kill sites to me are the cougar ones where you get bears coming in too. And it's really just awesome to see the caching behavior and the differences between like how wolves feed and how cougars feed. And even the differences in scavenger activity where, you know, you go to a cougar kill and it's all covered up, matted down. You know, spend 5 minutes digging out branches and debris or snow that they piled over the kill site. And there's hardly any scavenger sign. You know, you might get a bear that finds it because they just have such an incredible sense of smell. But other than that, you know, you really don't see a whole lot of scavenger sign, where if you get a wolf kill, you could see, you know, bear scat everywhere, ravens, eagles, and all this sign. And it's just cool to kind of pick apart, you know, you'll find an eagle feather here or a bear scat here, a huge bear bed that they dug out next to a tree. So it's just seeing that kind of, you know, imagining in your head those interactions unfolding, you know, from a week prior is just really cool.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, I could see you guys probably back in the I'm envisioning almost like a television show where they have sort of that board where it's, you can just sort of, so here we have the carcass and this, you know, the eagles come in here and the wolves are on this side and everybody's just trying to, like you said, sort of having that dueling back and forth of who's going to take this, you know, these different sections of the carcass away and help each other out. It seems like an interesting dynamic for all these species to, in a way, get along to be able to feed themselves.
Yeah, and sometimes we'll try and, you know, look at the GPS points and see, okay, well, they killed the bison here, but they only spent 2 hours here. So more than likely, you know, if there's bear sign, then they probably only got, you know, maybe 25% of that carcass where the bear came in and got the rest of it for that, you know, other 75% of the food. So it's cool to imagine how everything unfolded and see how much they fight over the different resources in, you know, as harsh of a landscape as Yellowstone.
Yeah, man. I'd love to see that. Oh, maybe we will when we head up there, Johnny.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we're short plug for, I mean, we are trying to get up there hopefully towards the end of winter, maybe in the beginning of spring. So
yep.
I don't know if your timeline works for that, Jack. I don't know if you're going to be done with your work in Minnesota, but we've spoken with a couple of your colleagues that we're trying to book a trip and get up there and do some podcasting and film some really awesome stuff with you guys. But I don't know if that'll coincide with your scheduling or not.
Yeah, with COVID and everything, all my classes, all my interactions with professors, everything's online right now. So who knows? Maybe I'll.
That's a bummer.
Duck out of here early and do the rest of my semester from Montana. I did that last semester and did the last month from Yellowstone. So
that'd be great.
I'd do that in March, come back in March for winter study if that's when you guys are planning to come out. So maybe I'll connect with you guys.
Oh, that'd be incredible.
That would be incredible.
Before we get into the impacts of Yellowstone carnivores on elk and bison, et cetera, I just had some general elk questions, like what's the average size of an elk there in Yellowstone? What's the average elk herd size? And those elk that, you know, when you're driving through Yellowstone that are just, they just seem to be permanently there. Are they migrating any time of year? Like, are they going anywhere else? Do they usually leave the park, or, you know, is that herd pretty central?
Yeah. So average elk size. So if you're looking at a female, probably around 300 to 400 pounds is, I'd say, the average weight of a female. Males, they can get up to about 700 pounds, so almost twice the size. Some of the other ones are, you know, maybe 500 to 600 pounds. And then average group size, I think Nathan was on, he said somewhere around 20, and I'd say that's pretty accurate. It definitely depends where you're at. They probably congregate in larger groups when you know, leave the park and get out in those open valleys, like out in Paradise Valley. You know, you'll see herds of 300 because there's no predators down in those agricultural fields, and they're just feeding on all that leftover grain or whatever they're growing out there. So it really varies in between, you know, as soon as you cross that park boundary and get towards town. But I'd say probably somewhere around maybe 15 to 20 is, you know, maybe average group size. And then, yeah, they're migrating. So it's really cool. It's every year, it's right on schedule. As soon as you get the first kind of big snowfall that hits the interior of Yellowstone, you see these mass migration movements, because we have quite a few elk collared as well with GPS collars. And you'll see usually around mid-October, or sometimes even earlier or later, you'll just see these mass migrations of, you know, 20, 30, 40 miles into that northern stretch of Yellowstone and extending out into, you know, Gardner, Paradise Valley, and that northern section of the GYE.
Awesome. And what age are they getting? Did they get up to elk normally, or at least the ones in the park?
Yeah. So average age of death is around 17. That's the average lifespan of elk in Yellowstone. But we actually just had last year our oldest collared elk ever passed away, which was 25.6 years old, I think.
Whoa.
And the teeth looked better than I would have thought. And that's probably why she lived so long, just because her teeth weren't wearing down and she could still, you know, chew and feed better than some of the other elk that were, you know, older and their teeth were wearing down. So that's the oldest elk I've seen.
Wow. That's old or ancient. Is that comparative to, say, a wolf that lives, you know, 9, 10? Is that something that's abnormal?
Yeah. So I'd say it's probably comparable to maybe a wolf hitting double digits. And the cool thing to think about is, and Doug wrote a story on this, was, you know, envisioning this elk's life, because when it was born in 94. So the year right before wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone. So you just got to think its entire life it lived through, you know, wolves coming back, cougars coming back, grizzly bear numbers increasing. And there's this whole shift that we've been studying for 25 years. This elk lived through it all.
Man, think about the story you could tell, just like you said, through that elk's eyes, just everything that it was a female, you said, right? Just to see like what that female elk, like you said, it's like it's a human being living the course of their life. They could say, oh, I remember when, you know, a large life event here. And, you know, for them just to survive that long, what did that elk eventually die from? Was it old age, or what was the call to death?
And what's the main cause of death for elk in the park?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the main cause of death is predation. As you get older, it would be most likely wolves or cougars. Bears are really only, you know, they might get an elk or maybe a rut-injured bull elk here and there, but bears really only kill those younger, you know, newborn elk calves that are really vulnerable. But yeah, predation is the primary source, and that elk actually ended up dying, we think, from one of the wolf packs that had recently formed that year in the area. It's funny, you know, she survived this 25 years of, you know, 170 wolves on the landscape down to 100. And then finally, we think, succumbed to a wolf pack. So,
wow.
I mean, do you ever find them dying of natural causes, or is that just not a thing you see very often?
Definitely less often now than back in the day. So when they were food limited, before wolves and other predators were in Yellowstone and on the landscape, they were just dying in, you know, massive numbers from the weather, from malnutrition, just not having enough food on the landscape, really poor conditioned elk. And now adult survival, I think, on average is a little over 90% from year to year. Mm. So most of them are living, and as they get older, they're just can't feed as efficiently, and sometimes they'll succumb to, you know, malnutrition late winter, and that's how most of them die, if it's not from a wolf or a cougar.
It sounds like it's like a combination of things. I mean, a healthy elk that has a lot to eat is probably not going to die during a harsh winter.
Exactly. And it's really once you hit, you know, maybe 10, 11, 12 is when body condition really starts to decline. Mm-hmm. And you really see the effects of weather. And that's even true with predation. So in some years when you get really bad winters, the elk are just in general in poorer condition, which makes it easier on the wolves to hunt too. So you might have more wolf predation that year because the elk are just in poorer condition. So you could have, you know, the indirect effects of weather and you know, poor foraging conditions that lead to a death by a wolf or a death by a cougar.
Do you see that these, I think Nathan touched on this a little bit too, that do you find that all of these species, especially, you know, the elk, cougar, wolf relationship, that all of these numbers and the physical specimens are healthier in general now than they were obviously when they got reintroduced, and that, you know, herds were thinning down to a more healthy rate? Do you see that across the board?
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, all the elk, from what we can see, are just overall healthier in terms of herds. And calves even, back when we did an elk calf survival study before wolves in like 87 to 90, you would have, you know, maybe 40 or 50% of those elk calves dying from malnutrition and winter conditions. And now there's almost none of that. Almost all elk calves are dying from predation sources like wolves, cougars, bears. So yeah, food isn't really limiting them much at all now.
That's great. I mean, to me, that would seem like that's the healthier balance that you want in an ecosystem, just in a big ecosystem like Yellowstone is. I want to run go back just for one question that I forgot to ask when we're talking about prey sites. What do you, so you said wolves typically spend, I don't know, a couple hours or so at a site. Do you see, because I was reading through Rick McIntyre's books a couple of times where they would make multiple trips from a kill site back to the pups. Do you guys know, have you been able to track that? Is that something that happens very often? So if they make the kill and they spend what, however long it is there, how much meat are they trying to consume to get back to the pups that are back at the den?
Yeah, so it's really cool when you have a breeding female or a female that had pups in a year that we're following for these predation studies, because it looks like the spokes on a wheel, really. You'll see, you know, the central axis where that den is located, and then you'll see, you know, trips going out from there, extending in all directions to these kill sites. And you'll see them go back, you know, multiple times sometimes. And in one sitting, a wolf can consume around 20 pounds of meat. So they'll get as much as they can in their stomachs, and, you know, they'll look all bloated and everything, take it back, feed the pups, and they might settle down for a while, or they might go, you know, straight back and grab some more. But
wow, that's an insane amount of meat. Is there ever any issues with, I don't know if you can try, is there any issues of bloat in wild wolves, or I don't know if mountain lions can get bloat, or cats typically get bloat, but I know that happens with domestic dogs and after you eat and they turn around and all these things, because these wolves or these cougars, they're going, you know, tens of miles sometimes from a kill site back to the den. So how do they, is there a way that they prevent it differently? Do you know about that? It just like,
yeah, for a domestic animal, that would be a recipe for colic or bloat.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think I haven't heard of any, you know, problems with digesting, you know, 20 pounds of meat. And I think it probably has to do with a lot of that, you know, evolutionary back story of, you know, wolves being on the landscape competing with bears and cougars, yeah, and other species, where they have to, you know, get 20 pounds of meat in before the bear shows up, and they need to capitalize on that. So I think their stomachs are just built perfectly for that. Yeah. And they have to work a lot harder than we do to digest their meat, because, you know, we can cook it and get more nutrients out of it. But as far as I know, yeah, I don't think they have any issues with that, like domestic dogs. And that might have been something that, you know, we breed it out of dogs over the course of, you know, thousands of years.
And it might, maybe it has something to do with eating like a full carcass. There's skin, there's hair, there's all sorts of things. It may be
organs,
digestive benefits, organs. Yeah. I mean, actually I've heard that is true with a lot of predators, that they do go for the organs first, or the more valuable, the more nutrient rich items. Is that something that you are, you know, can authenticate, or?
Yeah. So what you'll see is usually the first thing they do is pull out the stomach, because that's just full of, you know, grass stuff or other digestive material that they don't want. And that's really how we tell whether it's a wolf kill or a scavenge. So if the rumen pile, what we call it, is right next to the carcass, then it probably just died. Or if it has what we call, you know, poor marrow, not a lot of fat in it, that's a good indicator that it died of its own, you know, causes of malnutrition. Mm. Where what we see with wolf kills is they'll pull the rumen out first as soon as they get it down. And then you'll see drag trails of, you know, blood or hair mats and all that to where they actually fed on the kill. And they kind of work in and then out. So you'll see, you know, like you said, the organs and, you know, the inner parts right in the chest cavity being consumed first. And then they kind of start to work out towards the legs, the neck, the face. And it's incredible what they'll consume. I mean, we'll go to a bison kill with the Junction Butte pack now that has 34 wolves, and we'll find one bone shard there. Or an elk calf kill, sometimes, you know, they don't leave anything behind. They just consume it all, digest the bones and everything. And usually what we do find with those younger animals, or if we find anything, it's, you know, a hoof or a leg, those things that just, there's no meat on them, so they don't really touch them. But for the most part, they eat every scrap that they can find.
So they do eat the stomach contents as well, even though there's vegetation in there. I mean, I've heard that, like, you know, that, I mean, I guess they're, you know, they're carnivores, but that the small amount of vegetables that maybe canines evolved to eat, you know, was satisfied partially by them eating the stomach contents of ungulates that are filled with vegetables, or do they leave that usually?
Yeah, so they leave it completely. So usually if you get a freshly killed elk carcass, I had one time where they killed an elk right next to the road that morning and fed on it, and we had to move the carcass, and it was only, you know, an hour or two old. Rumen pile was perfectly intact, but they pulled it out of the stomach and left it there.
Wow.
Sitting right there, like pristine and untouched. Wow. Yeah, they don't want anything to do with that. And you'll see that at the kill sites too, where you see all the like dehydrated grass material that's like partially digested, just sitting in a big pile right there.
Wow.
And the kill, you know, 10, 20, 30 yards away sometimes.
Man, that is incredible. It's amazing how they know. I mean, obviously it's all evolutionary, but how they know where they can find those nutrients, you know, it's amazing how sometimes with humans, we have to be told where these things are, and that these predators are just, it is hardwired where I'm going to find the nutrients and the things that I need to survive to get back to either my pups or my kittens or whatever it is, in order for them to continue on and have that lineage continue.
Yeah, we have to have like a food plan written out. Otherwise we like forget what to eat. But I was walking our horse before out in the field behind us, and she was just picking out this very sharp, almost thorned bush, and she wanted that specifically. And she was just eating these things up. She just wanted to stop and just eat that specifically. She was sifting through stuff to find it. And I looked it up. I found a picture of it. And apparently it's very good for them. It's a high in iron plant. And she just knew by smelling it, I guess, or she, you know, they have some kind of sixth sense for what's good for them, what's not good for them.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Jack, do you know, like when you, in your studies and in your work, do you know sort of how that happens? Is there been papers or anything that's been, or studies that have been done to understand how that's possible, that they know what to go for? Or is it literally just instinct?
Yeah. Even a domestic dog is like, you can see it sifting through grass to find a specific type of grass that they want.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly, but you know, with us, I think it has a lot to do with palatability. So sometimes, you know, they'll eat what's tastes the best. And a lot of times, I think we've evolved with that trait of, you know, what's the most nutritious and fulfilling, obviously usually tastes the best. And for us, you know, if you eat a lot of people gravitate towards foods that are heavy in fat or sugars, yep. And that's because they taste the best. But, you know, it's not good for us because we're not regulated by, you know, the natural resources and weather and all this. But for an animal, you know, the thing you want the best is those fatty substances, you know, like for bears, it's pine nuts or what have you. And those are the highest in protein, the highest in calories, and the highest in fat. So I think it probably has a lot to do with, you know, just taste, and they can go by that.
Yeah, that's a good point, that maybe we do have that sense, but the thing is, our food's so manipulated that it's not, there's not a healthy regulation of substance in it. I mean, like, obviously we crave sugar because of a natural desire to find fruit in nature or something with sugar in it, but now that it's been totally manipulated for us, our sense is kind of dulled and
absolutely
messy.
Yeah, definitely.
So when you're like we said at the top, you're in Minnesota right now, you're studying for your master's, what are you seeing the difference with these packs? I don't believe cougars take bison. But what do you see? Is there this shift that you're seeing with wolves? Or let's start here. What's the difference in the predation sites that you see from an elk to a bison that you've been studying over the course of time?
Yeah, so with bison, because they're larger and they just take longer overall to consume, a lot of times you might see, you know, more scavenger activity, or, you know, a big bull bison that got killed by wolves or died from a rut injury. You know, those are the carcasses that, you know, typically might draw in, you know, a dozen grizzly bears plus a wolf pack plus birds, where a smaller elk is only going to draw in, you know, maybe one bear or a wolf pack and then some birds. But it depends too on, you know, the location, where elk, you find them in a lot more diverse areas. So you find elk in these open areas, but you also find them in steep canyon country. And that also plays a role in detectability by scavengers. So, you know, bison almost nine times out of 10, they're always going to be, you know, out in those open valleys, which is just easier in general for all these different scavengers to find. So that's definitely the biggest difference is between the site characteristics is just how many scavengers attend those areas.
And are you seeing a shift in wolf packs? Remind me which wolf pack it is that really takes down almost bison primarily. And what's the reason? Do you see that there's a shift that wolves are taking more bison than elk? Is that true, or is there any truth to that statement?
So over the years, the long-term average is around 90% of wolf diet is elk. And there's been some differences across packs that we've studied. So in the wintertime for, I think, over a decade, we had a crew that would spend 2 weeks at a time down in the interior of Yellowstone watching the Molly's pack in the Pelican Valley. And in the wintertime, the only prey that's available to them out there are these bull bison or other bison that just hang out and stay in the interior and don't migrate out of there. And they were taking exclusively bison and surviving only on bison during the wintertime there.
Wow.
And we haven't really seen that with a lot of other packs until in the last couple years, we've seen this interesting shift where wolves steadily kept increasing their kind of use of bison in the scavenger capacity. And some of that is probably just due to availability. Bison numbers have, you know, quadrupled since wolf reintroduction. And inevitably, they're, you know, at that high of numbers, they're going to be more food limited than they were when they only had 1,000 compared to, you know, 4,000 now. So that probably means there's more dying and malnutrition and more carcasses and scavenging opportunities for wolves on the landscape. And we've kind of seen this shift where wolves that originally came from the Molly's pack and have kind of dispersed into these other packs have now taken up that learned behavior of killing and predating directly on bison. And it's those packs that have some ties to the Molly's pack from genetics or are just very large packs are now taking quite a few bison and actually killing them rather than just scavenging on them. They're still taking elk predominantly over bison and still selecting for elk more than bison, but we're starting to see a shift where they might be using bison more and more in that hunting and actually killing capacity. And this year, this past winter, was the first time where they actually killed more bison than they did elk over the course of 25 years of our winter study data. And that pack's 34 wolves. So it's the biggest pack that we've had in 15 or almost 20 years since 2001 with the Druid pack. So this is, you know, an opportunity where you have a pack of 34 wolves. They can have a much easier time taking down a really large bison than a pack of 10 or a pack of 5.
So they were selecting for bison even though there was elk present?
So part of it is the elk have steadily been, their range has been shifting out of the park. And a lot of that has to do with the conditions. So in terms of predation, wolves obviously want to find an elk in deep snow because it's just going to be a lot easier for them to take it down. Because hunting as a wolf is just almost
hard.
Nearly impossible.
Hard.
Yeah. It's just hard. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, if you can imagine being, you know, 100 pounds, and you have your mouth, your paws can't do anything.
Yeah.
They don't rotate. That's what you have. And then that's kind of the whole reason, aside from territoriality, that we think for, you know, wolves living in pack dynamics. So,
isn't that crazy? It's like the fact that their joints behave the way they behave, it could potentially be this evolutionary driver for why wolf packs exist. I guess mountain lions supinate so they can take down giant prey with their claws, you know?
Yeah, and that's where you probably get them as being solitary versus
they don't need it.
Pack living. Yeah, and they have, you know, these retractable claws that are also really sharp, where wolf claws, you know, they stay out. They're just constantly getting rubbed up against and dulled, so they can't really do anything. So taking down, you know, 1,000-pound bison with your mouth, you're going to need some.
When you describe it, it's mildly inefficient, actually.
Yeah, it's good. But that's why the bite pressure is so much more, right? I don't know, what's the bite pressure on a cougar? Perhaps with Grange, do you know that?
I could probably Google that.
I want to say maybe it's, I think in the upper hundreds, maybe. I don't know. It's just a wild guess out there.
Yeah. But it's amazing. Yeah, how Steve was saying, yeah, that's why those packed
canines. They have larger canines too.
Yeah, it says cougar. That makes sense. It says cougar has a bite force of 350 pounds per square.
So that means a wolf's is four times that, roughly, right?
Yeah, but it's distributed across, you know, an entire jaw too.
Right. Cougar,
it's built more for, you know, quickly crushing things because they have a shorter jaw. They can distribute all of that pressure over a very small area.
To like a spinal connection or something.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so what do you think the long-term effects of this are going to be? Do you think with the elk migrating out or more out of the park and the bison, you know, basically being content to stay there, that there's going to be this seismic shift for wolves and predators to go more towards bison? And is there a difference between, excuse me, a difference between the meat itself between bison and elk? Is one more, you know, one more healthier than the other, or it really just depends on the animal?
Yeah, in terms of meat quality, I don't know that there's a huge difference. Maybe bison, you know, just like the difference between cattle and deer, maybe a little higher fat content or something around there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's like a substantial difference in that sense, or like a huge difference in palatability or taste. But a lot of the work that I'm maybe hoping to do is some predictive work of, you know, looking into the future a little bit, 5 to 10 years maybe, with how shifts have started to change now and seeing what those relationships might be like in the future to, you know, maybe predict and fuel management decisions moving forward of bison herds or of elk herds. But we are starting to see some signs of that shift. And I think it's really going to depend to some degree on pack size. So for elk, having around 4 to 5 wolves is perfect. That's all you need to have the highest hunting success of taking down elk. For bison, that number's a lot higher. It's, you know, once you get into 10, 11, 12, 13 wolves is really when your success rate of hunting bison starts to climb dramatically. And it's still, for both those species, only around 10% of the time they actually are successful in a hunt and in a kill. But if you start to see larger packs become more of the common, then I could see that shift maybe being fueled a little more than if you have, you know, average pack size. Long term is only around 10 wolves, where this year it's looking at maybe around closer to 15 wolves per pack, which might have something to do with the increased use of bison, just making it easier for hunting.
I see. So it's not even necessarily about the amount of wolves on the landscape. It's the pack size that would, you know, cause you to assume that they'll start targeting bison disproportionately to elk in the future.
Yeah. And as they learn and develop those, you know, traits and learn how to hunt bison more efficiently, that might precipitate that shift. Because in a lot of other systems, you see a lot of alternate prey use being driven by prey abundance. So as, you know, elk population declines, wolves might use more deer, or vice versa with moose and deer. But it's a lot different when you have vastly different difficulties in terms of hunting animals, like the difference between a bison versus an elk. It's a lot easier to hunt an elk. So if they develop those traits and learn how to hunt bison, you could see that precipitating and really developing that shift. But it'll be interesting to see in the next 5 to 10 years if they start killing more bison than elk, or using, you know, 50-50, or they still primarily use elk and don't hunt bison as much.
And I guess if they did start targeting bison more often, I guess that potentially could be a good thing for the bison herds, because they're already being culled, I assume, right, by management?
Yeah, exactly. So that's where, you know, if we have these predictive models, and there's, you know, something to be said about trying to predict the future, but
yeah, sure.
If it says, you know, we think wolves are going to start taking bison a lot more, that could give, you know, the interagency management team an idea of, okay, well, maybe in the future we might consider dialing back the amount of bison that we call, because wolves are helping with that now. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that changes and plays out.
Amazing.
So optimally, the future for you, what do you see as the optimal situation moving forward with, I guess, across these four, you know, between bison, elk, cougar, and wolf, what do you see as really your optimal scenario moving forward for all of these species?
Yeah, so right now, there's really no sign that wolves are having any real impact on the bison population. So calf survival is really, really strong. And that's why they need to do these calls every year, because there's just such high survival rates. So if, you know, this shift happens, you might see fewer calls or fewer bison that are even, you know, shifting out of the park because wolves might be killing them. Or you might see bison shifting out of the park more because wolves have started to hunt them. So I could see, hopefully, this balance where, you know, ideally, you know, cougars are staying kind of the same. Elk numbers have stabilized in the last 5 to 10 years. Wolf numbers have stabilized. Just seeing all those populations kind of level off and reach maybe an equilibrium. And, you know, nothing's really stable. It's kind of...
Sure.
In natural systems, but
constantly moving and changing.
Yeah, everything's constantly changing, but for a system as stable as it could get would be kind of cool to see that. You know, seeing wolves using elk as much as they use bison would be really cool to see all of that change unfold.
So when you finish your work, your studies in Minnesota, what's the new knowledge you're taking back with you? What's the goal of getting the master's at University of Minnesota?
Yeah, so I'm working under, you guys have probably heard of him. My advisor is Dave Meach, who has, you know, long been recognized as kind of the leading wolf biologist for the last 60 years. I mean, he started studying wolves back in, I think, 68. So he's been doing this for, you know, over 60 years now.
Wow.
So, you know, just part of grad school and master's programs is to develop the skills to become a better ecologist, become a better biologist. So my main goal is to kind of just take away, you know, learning a lot of the statistical procedures that, you know, nowadays a lot of wildlife work is just driven by, you know, ecological modeling and these really advanced statistical procedures. So learning and getting a great foundation in that, so that can kind of kickstart maybe future work for me, or maybe a PhD, or just start working with federal, state government, managing carnivores would be awesome too. And that, you know, would give me those tools to be able to do that in the future.
That's incredible. That's awesome, man. Steven, do you have anything you want to touch on before I ask Jack the final question?
I think it's time for our final question.
Final question. So we ask this to everybody who comes on. So Jack, when you hear the word wolf, what are some things that come to your mind?
Yeah, so this might be a cop-out answer, but the way I like to look at it, not in a bad way, but the word, you know, ordinary is what I hope would come to mind. You know, not controversial would be good, but just another animal doing its thing on the landscape. And, you know, every animal, you know, some animals may or may not be more important than others. And, you know, there's a lot of work out there advocating for certain species, but it'd be nice to see a world where the wolf is looked at like a cougar or a bear or an elk or a bison, and just seen as, you know, another essential part of an ecosystem, you know, just getting by, doing its thing to survive. Kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. I love that answer. I mean, that's to us, I mean, that's the goal, is for, like you said, for it all to sort of balance itself out and really just be codependent upon each other, including us as a human species. So Jack, give people a place, if you don't mind sharing your Instagram or your social media, where people can find you, because you take some really great pictures and you do some really awesome work. So is there anything we can promote? Anything we can show people, some of the things that you're doing?
Yeah, so my I haven't been as active in the last year or so as I probably like. I have a stockpile of wildlife photos that I want to get back into to posting. But my Instagram is J Rabe, so that's J-R-A-B-E followed by 21. And that's the same for Twitter, and then just my name for Facebook or other things.
Nice. So yeah, we're definitely, listen, you're on our list of, you know, people we want to, you know, connect with once we get this possible trip situated, like I said, towards the end of March, maybe early April. So we'll definitely be
actually,
in contact with you.
Am I making this up? But I swear I saw a video of you a few weeks ago. You were, I think it, you were in a, you were some, I mean, I assume you're in Yellowstone, but you, there was a drone filming you and you had like a, you know, some kind of receiver looking for a collar probably.
Oh, interesting. I don't know. I was on, I did an interview about a year and a half ago for PBS. It was the Age of Nature, like documentary series. And I was just on that, which was,
I think it was that. Yeah.
Me having to see my face over and over again in my voice.
Yeah.
As every single person I've ever met told me about it, but
it was wild, man. I was looking for, you know, I was just doing some general wolf searching. I was looking for new guests that we should ask to come on. And, I saw you in there and I wrote your name down in one of my personal notes. And then, it was like a few days after I wrote it down, we interviewed Dylan and then he gave us your name.
I love this whole, your whole contingent is tremendous. I can't wait to, like I said, we're going to interview Taylor and Maddie next week and there's more people to come. So I love your contingent. I love what you guys are doing. And very gracious of you guys to give up your time and, you know, just come on and share your stories and your knowledge with us. I mean, the community loves it. We love it. So I can't thank you enough for coming on, Jack.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. It's been a pleasure. And hopefully maybe I'll see you later this year. Or I need to get back to California maybe once everything settles down a little bit. Yeah, so maybe I'll come see you guys there. But
yeah, or Colorado when the wolves have officially landed.
Yeah, that's right.
Who knows? Maybe I'll end up working on that project 2, 3, 4 years down the road.
Ah, well, if that happens, we're good. We're here.
Oh yeah, exactly. Steven's right there in Durango, so he'll be able to handle that all out. So, this is great, Jack. Thanks again. This is awesome. Howls to everybody out there, and Steven, I'll be with you next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye, bye.
Looking to support Wolf Connection or sponsor one of the wolves in our pack? Just go to wolfconnection.org, click on the donate tab, and find out more information.